So this morning, we continue in our study of Genesis. We're now in the narrative of Abraham, and we are at chapter 14. If you remember from weeks before, Abraham, in faith, left Ur with his family toward the land that God was leading him to. He left Haran and the home of his father following God's call. And he made it first to Shechem, and in Shechem he built an altar, and he acknowledged his God. He then drew further into Bethel, and there he built another altar, and there he called upon the name of the Lord. He then continued on to the southern desert, to the Negev, and there he experienced a great famine. And it was there in that famine that Abraham departed from where God had called him. He went down to Egypt. He determined himself to go, and he concocted a deceitful strategy. He lied to the Pharaoh. He lied out of fear of man and a distrust of his God. But the Lord intervened, and Abram's deception was brought to light, and he was brought back to the land of God's promise. Once back to Bethel, Abram once again called upon the name of the Lord. Last week in chapter 13, it had become apparent that with so much wealth and so much livestock, he and Lot had to separate in order to avoid conflict between them. Despite being the elder, he offered Lot the opportunity to have the first choice of where to settle. And Lot chose the well-watered land. It was like Eden, he said. It was like Egypt. He chose that area despite the fact that that region was filled with wicked, great sinners against the Lord. No matter. Lot chose to settle there. Abram moved away from there and he settled in Hebron. And God renewed his promises there. And Abram built another altar unto the Lord to worship God. This morning we come to chapter 14. This chapter draws us immediately into a battle. And this may be the very first world war of nations. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioche, king of Elasar, and Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, these kings made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Adma, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is, Zoar. And all these joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Amim in Shaveth-Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites who were dwelling in Hazazon Tamar. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Adma, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out, and they joined the battle in the valley of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioche, king of Elasar, 4 kings against 5. Now the valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, and as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them, and the rest fled to the hill country. So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way. So I'm hoping this morning we're trying to put a map up for you to see and follow this. I think it'll be helpful to you. And so if you see the map, to get a picture for what's taking place as we walk through this campaign. So as we begin this chapter, one of the things that I think you should note is that this is one of the areas where there's a lot of artifacts that have been found in that region that display the historicity of this section. It's what they have. They're housed in the British Museum, and these artifacts, they validate the names, the dates, the places, not only the names and the places, but even the alliances and the outcomes. they find that all of it lines up. And so with that, we begin in the days of these four kings. Amraphel, the king of Shinar, Arioche, the king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and Tidal, the king of Goim. These are four kings of the greater Mesopotamian region to the east of the Promised Land. Now, it's thought that Tibal was a king that was north of Israel, northwest of Mesopotamia, probably up around where Turkey is at. And he's the king that has the least historical backing, the least of the name recognition that we have. Arioche is better pronounced Ari-Aku. You know what his name means? His name means the servant of the moon god. Now, if you've been paying attention through this study, you might guess that he comes from the exact same region that Abram's family had come from out in Ur, and his kind of center of gravity was in Haran. Amraphel, his name means keeper of the gods. He has several mentions in the artifacts discovered, and just recently, what's interesting, in the last 2 years, they've unearthed the monument celebrating his uniting of the region of Babylonia with the placement of his capital city in Babylon. The last one is Chedorlaomer. He's said to be of the lineage of Elam. If you remember from Genesis 10, Shem's oldest son was Elam. And the Elamite dynasty lasted for a very long time, and Chedorlaomer was said to be of the true bloodline, of the lineage of the Elamites, the Persians, what would be today modern-day Iran. So, the background is Chedorlaomer seems to be the biggest of these four kings at the time, and he had made the cities, or the regions of the Dead Sea, over in the Promised Land, that area, his tributaries. What's a tributary? It's a city or a kingdom, a people who have to pay tribute, taxes. And so he had come in and he had said that he was the authority over this whole entire region and they were to pay taxes to him. Well, it says in the scripture that this went along fine for about 12 years, verse 4. But in the 13th year, these cities had had enough. And so these cities and regions joined together and they formed an alliance to oppose this Elamite king, Chedorlaomer. And so their alliance was between five, and they're called in the Jewish stories lesser kings. And these five kings were Bera, the king of Sodom, Bersha, the king of Gomorrah, Shinab, the king of Admah, and Shemeber, the king of Zeboim, and there's an unnamed king of Zoar. When you think about the battle that's about to take place, this isn't a good versus evil battle. This is an evil versus eviler battle. This is a group of nine kings, and they all have problems, right? The lesser five kings, they rule over who? We know who they rule over. A wicked, sinful people who are fueled by lust and sensuality. It's a people that are opposed to God. These are the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, all of the places that later are going to get destroyed by the Lord. Well, these are the kings of those areas. The four kings from the east that are coming in, well, they rule over an idolatrous, sinful people that are fueled by power and greed. So you have this war of power and greed over sex and lust. And they kind of come together here in this battle that's shaping up. And so the five kings, after 12 years of paying taxes to Chedorlaomer, they decide enough is enough and they rebel. And so it says in the 13th year, they stopped paying their taxes. Well, they thought that they were being taxed unfairly, and so they declared their independence. And so we might know something about that. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer then comes to take care of this situation, and he's made an alliance himself with Amraphel, Ariaku, and Tidal. And they, with their armies, gather in the north, and they follow what's called the King's Highway. In the scriptures, it's not called the King's Highway. Why? Because this is a vital trade route that goes from Mesopotamia down through the Middle East all the way down into Ethiopia. It's the major trade route, but everyone calls it the King's Highway. Do you know why they call it the King's Highway? Well, you're about to find out. It's chapter 14. It's these nine kings in the battle, and this is the track that the kings took, and so that's why it's called the King's Highway. They come down from the north, And if you can see, I think there's a map potentially that you're seeing it. Good. And they come down from the north and they sacked the Rephaim in Ashtaroth Karnim at the top. Now, what you need to understand is, who are the Rephaim? These are a people that are a line of giants. Later on, anytime you find the I-E-M at the end, the Eem behind the people group, they're basically a way of saying that these are big people. These are giant people. Goliath, who comes later, is considered a giant from this line. Goliath, we're told, was 4 cubits and a span, according to the Septuagint. Oftentimes, you see him displayed as like this 12-foot giant. 4 cubits and a span is 6 foot 6 inches. So if you start thinking about some of our big basketball players, you get an idea of about the size of this group of people, this line of people. Very large, very strong, very wicked. These are warriors. And it says that they went right through them. They were able to defeat that first group. They worked their way down this route. Then they sacked the Zuzim, another group of giants in Ham, and then the Emim in Shaveh, Kiriathaim. These are more giants known for strength and for fighting. And so this alliance of these four kings, they're vicious and they're effective. This is a strong army that's moving through. And every time they move through another city, they gain strength because they sack the cities and they collect all of the spoils. They take people to be their slaves. They enlist folks into their armies. They take all of the silver, all of the gold, all of the spoils. They continue south. They then take the Horites. And as they're going all the way down to the bottom, they stop at the border. They're not going to go into Egypt. And so they don't go into Egypt. And so then they turn north. And as they move north, they sack the Amalekites in Kadesh. And then they come up through the Amorites in Hazazon Tamar, until they come to the Valley of Siddim off the southwestern tip of the Dead Sea, really close to the Negev. And the five rebel kings decide this is where they'll fight. This is where they come to fight. And so we have the five kings versus the four kings and all of their people and all of their armies. We're not told much about the battle, but we can tell from what is told to us who wins and who loses this battle. Because it says the five kings flee. And so they're in retreat. And what we find is it's not going well for the rebel five. And so as they flee the fight, many of them are falling into the tar pits. And so when you see in your Bibles the bitumen pits, this is a tar pit. And then the rest ran away into the hills. And so you have the army of these five kings just scattered, which leaves their cities unguarded and ripe for the picking. So the four kings and all of their armies sack Sodom and Gomorrah, and they take everything of value, and they head north. But they unknowingly make one terrible mistake in verse 12. They also took Lot and all of his possessions. It's probably the only reason that we're told of these five kings versus these four kings, this battle, is because of the fact that it comes in and now they're dealing with God's family, God's line that he's dealing with here. And so we follow that line now. This morning, what I want to do is, this is a chapter that's sometimes hard to preach because it's a lot of history, it's a lot of names, it's a lot of places and all that kind of stuff. But what hit me this week as I was going through it was verse 12. And so what I'm going to do this morning is I'm going to stop preaching for a moment and start pastoring. And this verse 12 has a pastoral message that I want you to notice this morning. I want you to understand it's not the main thrust of this chapter. But what I want you to do is I'm going to use this as an illustration. I couldn't shake it off. We knew from chapter 13 that Lot had moved near into that region, near to Sodom and Gomorrah and all these wicked cities. But what we find out in chapter 14, that we're told by this time he had moved into the city. He was amongst these people of Sodom and Gomorrah, and when the city is sacked, he's among the spoils of the city. He's part of the spoils that's taken by these four kings. One of God's own people is among the spoils of Sodom. Let that sink in for a moment. He looked like all the rest of the folks, so when they're gathering everybody up, there's no difference between him and all the rest. So he's just part of the spoils that's going to go out with Sodom. know what's really sad is later on in a few chapters, you're going to see it happen again, different way. But what I want you to see this morning is it was his proximity to this wickedness that led to his being taken captive. Did you hear that? This is your pastor talking. It's his proximity to their wickedness that led to his being taken captive. His closeness to Sodom's culture. He looked like just another one of the city's population. Just another Sodomite. And so I move for a moment from being your preacher to your pastor, and I'm going to take this opportunity. Have you ever wondered why God was so adamant about his beloved people being separated from all those who were not his people? Why was it that God wanted them so separate? We know the outcome of it. Was it because he wanted them to be proud, cliquish? Did he want them to show that they were better than everyone else? No. Was it strictly to preserve a bloodline so that their bloodline would not be corrupted? Was it about the biology of these people? No. It's about corruption. It's about corruption. He did not want his people corrupted. Why did God call Abram out of Ur? And then away from his relatives. And then out of his father's house. It was because he did not want their influence. He wanted to pull them out of those places. And so he called him out of darkness into his light. And so he called him out of his country, out of his relatives, his family, out of even his own father's influence over him. Why? Because he wanted Abram to be his own alone. He wanted him to be set apart. He wanted Abram to be separated unto him for his purposes. Separated unto him for his purposes. Do you know what that's called? It means that he wanted Abram to be holy. So that word means separated unto God for his purposes. That's holy. Why is our God holy? It's because he's unlike any other God. He's not like any of the gods that people make for themselves. He is not like any of us. He's not like anything else. He's holy. R.C. Sproul used to say, he's not just a little bit holy. He's holy, holy, holy. He is altogether different, altogether set apart. And if he is a God who is holy and unlike any other, then his follower, the one who has his faith in him, the one who is adopting as his son, the one who is his friend, is going to be like no other. He's going to be set apart from the rest. God makes it very clear as you read through the Old Testament that this is his purpose, and this is what he wants his people to understand. Over and over and over again, you hear this: I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves. Consecrate yourselves, which means dedicate yourselves to me. Be holy, for I am holy. Set yourself apart for me, because I'm set apart from all the others. And so be holy, for I am holy. Leviticus. Here's another one. I am the Lord that brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy. Why? For I am holy. Later on, you find another verse. You are to be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from the peoples to be mine. I want you to be my possession. I want you to be my child. I want our relationship to be just between you and me. I want you set apart from everything else. Our God is not like any other. He is holy. I want you to just stop for a moment and think of all of his attributes. All of his attributes. In every single one of his attributes, whether it be his grace or his justice, his strength, his power, in every single one of his attributes, he is holy, holy, holy. He is not like any other. And so, those who would be his children, they ought to be holy too. Now, beloved, that's not just an Old Testament idea that ends when we get to the middle of the book. No. Listen to what we're told through the New Testament. 2 Corinthians 6:17, we're told to go out from their midst, be separate from them. Romans 16:17, we're told avoid those who create obstacles for you. Titus 3:10 says, have nothing more to do with those who stir up division. 2 Thessalonians, keep away from any brother walking in idleness or following any other teaching but the gospel. 2 John, don't receive any into your house who don't follow God's teaching. He goes on, he says, don't even greet them. Ephesians, take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness. 1 Corinthians 15:33, don't be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. 2 Timothy 3:5, avoid people that seem to be godly but deny its power. 1 Corinthians 5, don't associate with anyone who bears the name of a brother if he's guilty of sexual immorality or greed, if he's an idolater, a reviler, a drunkard, or a swindler. Don't even eat with him. 1 John 2, 15-17 says, do not love the world or the things in the world. God says in that chapter, if you love the world, it's an indication that you don't love me. You can't love both. You're going to love one, you're going to hate the other. Proverbs 13:20 is something we should all know. The companion of fools will suffer harm. Well, that's a lot, right? That's a lot right there. Now, in that list that I just gave you, the people that we're supposed to separate from are not just the world. It's those that might even be in the church that are not living the way they ought, that they themselves are not separating themselves. And so not only are we to separate from the world, we're to separate from those in the church who have not separated themselves from the world. That's the warnings that we have here. Why? You're a chosen race. You're a royal priesthood. You are a holy nation. You're a people for his own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness and his marvelous light. That's what Peter tells us. Do you know who you are? You're a holy nation. You're a people who carry his name. You're a people who've been adopted into his family. Not only have you been created in his image, you now are being conformed to the likeness of his son. Now 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14. We're told, don't be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? What portion does a believer share with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? We are the temple of the living God. And this is what God said, I will make my dwelling among them, and I will walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, go out from their midst. Be separate from them, says the Lord. Touch no unclean thing. Then I'll welcome you and I'll be a father to you. You'll be sons and daughters to me. That's what the Lord Almighty says. Friends, we are a people who live like Lot. We live right in the middle of a culture that is hostile to God. And I won't go into detail this morning how like Sodom we are, but I will say that Sodom's sins have nothing on Los Angeles. Living so close in proximity to this kind of sinfulness, we have to be on guard always. It's so easy to be corrupted by the world, to go along with the flow. And beloved, I don't think we have anywhere near the understanding of the extent that our living here so close to this has influenced us already, impacted our priorities, influenced our investments, dictates our entertainments, informs our recreation, draws our affections, feeds our appetites, leads to our habits and our addictions. This morning, a question I would ask you, are you living set apart from the culture? Now, when I ask you that, normally I'd ask you that, you'd say, oh no, right in the middle of it. Right now, you are a little set apart, right? And that's one of the reasons that I'm bringing this out this morning. For 45 days, you've been set apart from this culture, at least to some extent. And so I take this opportunity this morning to encourage you because it's about to get lifted. The stay-at-home order is going to lift, God willing, soon. And what I hear from people is they are chomping at the bit to get back to their normal lifestyle. I can't wait to get back to my normal lifestyle. Beloved, this morning I want to tell you is a God-given opportunity not to do that. Not to do that. For 45 days, you've been pulled away from friendship circles. You've been pulled away from a lot of distractions, a lot of entertainment, a lot of restaurants, a lot of things that get you into trouble, a lot of places you shouldn't go. So what I want to do is ask you to spend the last few days of your quarantine seeking the Lord to discern, once the freedom is returned to us, what's going to be different? What's your new normal going to look like? You know, the old life had its old lifestyle that was normal. What's your new life, this new opportunity for a new lifestyle, what does that look like? What are you going to go out from? What are you going to avoid? What are you going to have nothing to do with? What is it that you're going to keep away from? What is it that you're going to take no part in? What is it that you're going to not associate with? How are you going to separate yourself from this corrupt place? Just using all of those New Testament ideas, right? Avoid, have nothing to do, keep away, take no part, don't associate. What is going to be different? How are you going to move yourself a little bit away from Sodom? And I wrote a little note to myself, and don't misunderstand, I'm not calling any of you to move away and to hide out. That's the last thing I would ask you to do. No, we're called to live in the city, aren't we? I feel like I'm called here. My wife would say that, well, she has a different way of looking at how we're called to the city, but we're called to live here, and we're here to serve him while we're here. And as we live here in this city, how are we to behave? We're supposed to be ambassadors. Ambassadors of who? We're supposed to be witnesses. Witnesses of who? We're supposed to be servants. Servants of who? We're not to live for ourselves. Beloved, if you want to look at the culture that we live in and what you really need to avoid, is this culture lives for itself. It lives for its own glory, its own power, its own strength, its own desires. Everything about it is self-absorbed. We've been set apart. Our God is holy, therefore we ought to be holy. We ought to be different. We don't live for ourselves. We live now for him. Lot chose to move himself and his family not only near the city, he brought his family into the city, and his proximity to them resulted in his captivity. So the four kings took Lot along with all the other spoils of Sodom. And in Genesis chapter 14, then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and of Aner. These were allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men born in his house, 318 of them, and they went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. And then he brought back all the possessions, and he also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and the people. Abram hears of his brothers. Legally, he's his nephew, but he's moved into the place of his brother, and so he would consider him to be his brother. And his brother, he hears about his brother's captivity, and he drops everything. He leaves his house, and he leads his trained men all that were born in his household. There's 318 of him, and it seems like he's got those allies. They told us that those allies, they go with him, and they go after these marauding four kings, this army. Think about this army that has just done that loop that you saw on that map. They sacked giants, warriors, seasoned battle. This is a group that is scary. This is a group that has already had 15, 20 battles, won them all. Doesn't bother Abram. They have his brother. And so he goes after them. He goes in pursuit of them, and he divides his men. They attack at night, and they defeat the four-king army. And not only do they defeat them, they chase them out of the land of God's promise. And then he brings back Lot with all of his possessions, the women and the people, and all the spoils that the four-king army had taken. Again, friends, here is I'm going to take off my preacher hat and now put on my pastor hat. Because I think there's another group of folks that I want to speak to this morning. How hard would it have been for Abram to not just say, well, that's what he gets. You know, if you make those types of people your friends, then that's the result of those type of friendships. If you live close to the fire, at some point you're going to get burned. If you walk too long on the cliff edge, it's only a matter of time till you fall. Not only would it have been hard, just naturally, but then add this. He was living right. He had given the offer. You pick first. He chose to go where all those sinful people are. Abram went north. He went to Hebron. He's living right. He's sacrificing. He's keeping his heart in check. He's taking what God has given him. He's content with what he has. He's not like Lot. Lot chose to be there. Lot knew the wickedness of that area, and he decided that that's where he wanted to be. And now he's in trouble. And I'm supposed to get him out of trouble. Am I my brother's keeper? You look at the example that we're given here of Abram, this man of faith, he answers it for all of us. And Abram's answer, and he answers it immediately, is, yes, I am. He drops everything and he goes to the battle. And trust me, with as much damage as they've been doing through that loop, Abram is very much aware of how dangerous and how strong this army is. Friends, this is what I want you to hear this morning. Some of you are trying really hard to separate yourselves from the world. You're living humble lives. You're fighting for contentment. You're thankful to God for everything that he's given you. You're sharing the Savior. You're making changes in your life. You're letting God change you. And we know how hard of work that is, isn't it? You know, we always think it's hard to change. No, what's really hard is to let God change you. That's what's really hard. And you are a people that are letting God lead in your life. You're following his word. And I'm sure you have some Christian brothers and sisters who maybe aren't always as careful as you are. And maybe you have some Christian brothers and sisters who flirt with the world a little too much. Those who don't always heed your gentle warnings. Those who have made their homes too close to Sodom. And you know what happens with those Christian brothers and sisters that live too close to Sodom? They often, quite often, get themselves into trouble. They fall into traps. They get taken captive. So, beloved, what are you to do? Are you supposed to lecture them? What you get. You're not always really sad to see some of them get into trouble for some of those things. We think, let's let them squirm a little while in captivity so they really get a good taste of what this feels like. It's not the example that we're given with Abram, is it? He dropped everything. He put himself at risk, and he went into the battle for his brother in order to do what? Bring him back. Is this what we're called to do? Yes. Yes, we're called to go and restore our brothers who get caught in all kinds of transgressions. If they sin against us, what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to go to them alone, quietly. Speak truth into their life. Bring the light to that dark place that they're at. And it says that when they respond in the right way, you've gained them. Sometimes you go to your brother, your sister, they listen, you've gained them. We gently shine God's truth into their life. Jesus taught us in the parable that if one of the sheep gets lost, we leave the 99 to go and get the one and bring it back. Some may ask, well, how many times ought I have to do that? I think most of you who are in this camp know the answer to that question. I'm going to hold up here this morning. I'm not going to go forward because the next section I want to have time to open up. In this chapter, where secular history is visible in God's story, we see the truth of God's word. We see the motivations of these worldly kings, their cruelty, their quest for power and greed. We see rebellion and its willingness to wage war. But we're following the characters that God has brought to light for us, that God draws our attention to in Abraham and Lot. And so, as your pastor this morning, I want you to learn from their examples, both from their bad examples and from their good. I think there's a lot for us to consider before the Lord this morning. For the last 45 days, we've been separated from the world, at least to some extent. In the next few weeks, the restrictions are going to lift, God willing. And so this is what I would encourage you to do this morning. I want you to consider this, that this might be a divinely appointed opportunity for you to make a move, to move yourself a little further away from Sodom, to evaluate what was in the old normal life that needs to be taken out so that I might live this new normal life unto Him, a holy life. I'm not talking about a literal move away. I'm not advocating for you to move out of California, at least not yet anyway. Figuratively, I want you to reflect with the Lord. Once this is lifted, how will I spend my time? Where's the first place you're going to go? What's the first thing you're going to do? You haven't been able to spend your money, so y'all got, you know, those that have kept working, you got a lot saved up right now. Where are you going to spend it? Where are you going to put it? Who will you call your friends, spend your time with? What are you going to watch on TV? The movies are going to open again. What movies are you going to go see? Are you going to go see movies at all? What is it that will build us up, mature us, draw us closer to Him, set us apart for His service, make us more holy? How will we let God change us and move us and lead us? And what will do the opposite? That's what I want you thinking about in these last days of the quarantine. All of us have to live in this world. The question is, how much of this world are we a part of? And how much of this world are we separate from? Separate unto the Lord. Beloved, our God is holy. He is holy, holy, holy. Therefore, we ought to be holy too. We'll pick it up at verse 17 next week.